Welcome to Social Distance Central. Wait, that's what this is now? You're on Sportsnet 650. Here's Bick Nizar and Brendan Batchelor.
Welcome to Social Distance Central, the show with the COVID name. It's not about COVID during the COVID era. I'm Bick Nizar, and with me is Jamie Dodd, who you just heard on the Scott Rintoul show, praising Aaron Rodgers.
That's right.
What's going on, Jamie?
I spent the morning sifting through angry replies to me on Twitter for daring to suggest that Aaron Rodgers has had a more dominant career than Alexander Ovechkin.
Yeah, you were out of pocket, man. You were wilding. I'm pretty sure you found all my burner accounts.
Yeah, I told you about this morning. You were not impressed with me. It's recency bias. It's all recency bias, man. Aaron Rodgers was so legit at his peak. People forget that now.
I saw the poll question, and I was like, I sent you a text. I was like, what side are you on? So I know what to roast you later on Central.
Yeah. Well, whatever. It's close. People are acting like it's a crazy, like, oh, how could you say that? Whatever. It's close. Even if you're on the other side of it. Come on. Get real.
We appreciate the takes, man. And that's what we're all about here on Social Distance Central, of course, with Game of Takes on this show, which is underway now. If you jump online at Sportsnet 650, you can get your takes in. As you and I talked about it a lot last week, but we're turning it over to the listeners and to the fans of the Vancouver Canucks of, hey, team tank or team win? Where do you stand on this? And of all people to chime in, Finn chimed in. And his take, we'll just read it out here. Stupid question. You play to win, period. So that's Finn's take. I couldn't do it with the Finn accent of the whale noises, but I imagine that's how it sounds.
I was going to say, is Finn's character able to talk, or is it just whale noises?
He might be the clubhouse leader for who's going to take on Nick this week for Game of Take. So you got to come in with a take stronger than Finn's. Is how this is going. And he might get disqualified if he can't talk.
Yeah, that doesn't make for good radio, whale sounds.
It does. It just depends. Okay, it's Bick Nizar, Jamie Dodd. A lot going on today. Obviously, you heard Chris Tanev talk on the Scott Rintoul show with, wouldn't believe it, Scott Rintoul. So, you know, it kind of reignites the conversation of where do we stand with Chris Tanev as far as his future. I think in the short term, we talk about his application in a series versus the Minnesota Wild. And in the short term, you think, okay, it looks obvious that given what he was talking about, how the talent on this team is, they feel like they can win any game, and more in particular, any series, and hang and skate with anyone. So in the short term, it's obviously not a big issue. But long term, with Chris Tanev, is wherein lies the question.
And it does seem to me, anyways, like we're heading for a short-term resolution to this question, just based on the flat salary cap, the Canucks situation, what Chris Tanev has said about a desire to stay in Vancouver. I don't know if he's going to be able to hit the open market and get any sort of long-term deal, or at least not to the degree with the money he might be thinking about. So right now, if you ask me to put money on it, I'm betting that Chris Tanev stays in Vancouver with the Canucks, but on a short-term deal, at least this go-around.
And the more people have been worried about the term. I'm more worried about the AAV just because does it exclude you from being able to make some of the other decisions like a Tyler Toffoli or like a Jacob Markstrom? And then if it is, you know, term with a AAV similar to now, and look, Chris Tanev is a very good player and has value. And I do think he's going to earn and deserve his next contract. It just, I get concerned at giving defensive D-men $4.5+ million when we see that those are the contracts around the league that don't necessarily hold up as much value. We'll pitch that to Greg Wyshynski and also talk about some of the return to play scenarios as he joins us now from ESPN. Wish this week, how have you kind of ingested it all. It's kind of a history-making moment for the NHL as they get ready to return to play in this pandemic moment.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. You know, it is sort of history, and not only with the return to play stuff, but obviously with the CBA stuff. And yeah, I think I've reacted like a lot of people. It's incredible to look. Gary Bettman's a lot better at canceling seasons than he is rescuing seasons. Let's be honest, right? So, like, the idea that we're going to get this thing cooking again and manage to get a new CBA without any kind of league instigated work stoppage is a pretty remarkable thing.
When you look at how the other leagues are operating and considering how, by and large, this has gone without hiccups. I know Artemi Panarin said a couple of things and a couple of players voiced their opinions on escrow and all that. But by and large, to get here, it's been pretty smooth sailing. And it feels like, by all accounts from any scientist, health authority, it's that the NHL is doing the right thing. This is, you know, when history will flex back upon it. It feels like the NHL is going to be looked upon quite well of how they handled this.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's been surreal to see fans and media that cover other sports look at Gary Bettman and say that's a guy who has his act together. As hockey fans, this is not something we're used to. But the fact of the matter is that the league's done a really good job. And, you know, they put out their postseason plan before anybody else. And, you know, their return to play protocols seem like they're pretty good if everything is followed to a T. And then when it comes to the CBA, you know, the winds were always blowing for the last couple of years towards the idea that this was not going to be the rockiest of negotiations. There was a lot of common ground between the two sides. And more than that, there wasn't an overlying issue that the owners would point at and say, okay, we need to shut things down until we get this thing fixed. There's no salary cap or rethinking the financial system of the league or anything like that. So without absent that, it was always going to be kind of a smoother negotiation than maybe we're used to. And then obviously with the COVID-19 thing, now the two sides have to really get cracking to figure out how they're going to handle not only what the players needed to do to, you know, make it a 50-50 split with the owners with this revenue loss, but also because of this revenue loss, figuring out how they were going to manage the salary cap going forward, considering the owners, you know, got their salary cap linked to revenue and now there's no revenue. So what happens with the cap? So all these things happening at the same time, I think, only expedited the cooperation between the two sides.
Greg, Gary Bettman, I think, is quite rightly getting a lot of credit for getting this deal done. But on the other side, how much credit does Donald Fehr and the NHLPA deserve? You know, I remember when Fehr joined the NHLPA coming over from the baseball union, you know, he had a reputation as a pretty tough negotiator and someone who would really go to war with the players. And I'm just curious, what do you make of the job he's done getting all the players on board and shepherding this deal through?
Well, I've talked to a few people about this, and so I'm going to separate this out. I think the players have done a really good job. You know, did they go far enough? Well, no, but that's because I grew up in a union house and I want them to peace out on July 9th and go and fight for a luxury tax instead of a salary cap. But they're never going to do that. So absent the big fight, I think the players did a good job in salvaging the season and getting some good things for themselves going forward. I've talked to a few people about Don Fehr's role in all this, and frankly, I'm not trying to diminish it. I think that he's done good work behind the scenes, but it's not the same. It's not a correlation to what Bettman does. You know, Bettman really pilots the ship when it comes to the NHL's negotiations. I think this was more of a collaborative effort on the part of the National Hockey League Players Association, led by, you know, the players that have been pretty active in these negotiations, as well as a lot of the support staff for the NHLPA. I don't necessarily think this is, you know, something that Don Fehr has had his hands on and has been piloting in the same way that Gary Bettman has, if I'm being told the right things by some of the sources I spoke to.
And it's obviously a big deal that they've been able to reach this agreement and extend the CBA and put all these protocols in place. But as we know, and as we're seeing in other sports, when you're dealing with COVID, things can change really, really quickly. As of right now, July 7th, how confident are you that the NHL will be able to not just get back on the ice and start playing again, but see the whole process through and award the Stanley Cup at the end of this season?
Well, I mean, first thing we got to have is this vote by the players. And when it comes to the CBA, you can never be positive. You know how the vote's going to go. It does seem like, you know, if there's sort of a memorandum of understanding about this agreement, that bodes well for the players just kind of falling in line and approving the thing. But, you know, let's not count our chickens quite yet on that. As far as getting through training camp, I mean, that might be the trickiest thing, because you're going to have all these teams in their own bubbles versus being in the NHL's bubble. I think you're going to continue to see positive tests, and hopefully not to the point where there's any reason to panic. But I don't think that we should be naive about the fact that once these players start returning from wherever they've been, there's a very good chance we're going to see a lot more positive tests. The real question is the bubble, and, you know, what will happen when they get there. And I've talked to a number of epidemiologists over the last couple of months, and they've all kind of said the same thing, which is that if you can test every day, which is what the NHL intends to do, and if you can make sure that the bubble that you've created is airtight to the point where you're not having much interaction with the general public, if any at all, you can pull this thing off. And, you know, reading through the documents for phase four that the NHL released yesterday, I think they've got a good plan. And then it's just a matter of whether they, and more importantly, the players and the staff and everybody else, can follow through on the protocols that they've developed.
Talking to Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on Social Distance Central, Bick Nizar and Jamie Dodd. What's interesting too, and I was going to touch on it later, there was a cool thread from our friend Justin Bourne. It kind of gave me pause, because I've been very vocal on the league kind of deserves this chance to, you know, run their business and come back in a state of a pandemic. And Justin tweeted on the idea of, you know, quoting that we knew there would be positive tests and this is, you know, what the league expected. And he kind of made the point of it'd be nice to have some idea of what the leagues actually did expect. And at one point, does it maybe get irresponsible to say, okay, there's been so many tests, do you have the resolve to actually close this down? So I'm curious if you have known any of your conversations of, you know, what the league expects and, you know, how willing are they going to be to actually, if something flares up, to pull all of this back?
It's a good question. I've been asked a few times from various people about thresholds and what the numbers are for those thresholds and what they look like. And I think they've been intentionally vague about that kind of thing. They don't want to put a number on it and say, okay, this many positive tests, we have to rethink this thing. I think they're kind of treating it, you know, like the old line about, you know, what is art? Well, I know it when I see it, right? I think we'll know
right
when it gets out of hand when they see it. Or to the point of what the document tells us, if the National Hockey League Players Association steps up to Gary Bettman and says, okay, we've got a problem here. And then there are mechanisms in place, including the potential for arbitration on whether or not they can continue the tournament. My curiosity is how forthcoming they're going to be about the testing when we're in the bubble. Right now, everybody's returning. There's tests. There's numbers. We're getting them now and again. How many players have tested positive, that sort of thing. That's all well and good. And I think that it's all stuff that we anticipate should happen as they're in this phase. Phase four is contingent on them showing that the protocols they put in place have created a safe environment for these players, for staff, for everybody else. I hope that they're as forthcoming with the numbers then as they are now. And I am really curious how they're going to handle these situations when, you know, the top line center from a team or the starting goaltender from a team all of a sudden disappears for 2 weeks and they're not releasing the information that this player tested positive for COVID-19. But it's A, obvious to all of us that they have, and B, it'll probably come out anyway that they did. So I'm not quite sure. Right now they're saying, you know, no names, no nothing. But I don't know how logical that approach is going to be once we get inside the bubble and that information is getting out anyway.
And I'm curious, you know, like that's the league's perspective. And we see it every time the NHL PR puts out a tweet of their latest testing numbers or anybody in any sport that, you know, announces that they had a new case. We see the cancel the season, cancel sports kind of logic. And so sports is coming back, or at least they're going to attempt to. I'm just curious from your point of view as just a hockey viewing fan, at some point during this process, if it becomes 6 new cases, 7 new cases, does it shift for you to say, oh, okay, maybe we shouldn't be doing this?
I mean, I'm already there on whether or not we should be doing this. I mean, it's a pandemic, right? And I'm not entirely convinced that even if they follow through these protocols, that this thing couldn't just go sideways. I mean, I think that picking the two hub cities they picked versus a place like Nevada or, God forbid, Florida, you know, makes it more possible that they could pull this thing off. But I don't know. I don't know what the numbers would be. I also think that, you know, it's a very curious disease in the sense that you do have people that are asymptomatic and that you have people that get absolutely wrecked by it. And it's hard to wrap your brain around that as well. I mean, it's clearly spelled out in the protocols that there's a much different situation if you're asymptomatic and test positive. You can come back on the ice in theory in like 72 hours versus if you're symptomatic and we might not see you for more than 2 weeks. So it's a tricky thing. And all you can do is hope they've worked it out and hope that they've relied on good medical science and the advice of their you know, pandemic experts, and not just trying to do this to put a Band-Aid on the revenue bleed that they're going to have this season.
I want to talk about that revenue bleed more in just a second, Greg. But, you know, we've heard from some key figures in other sports publicly admit basically that they're much more worried about health and safety than they are about actually getting back and playing or trying to win. I mean, Craig Counsell, manager of the Milwaukee Brewers, came out the other day and said he's not even thinking about the season. He's just trying to keep his guys healthy. We've heard from some teams, you know, on the fringes of the playoff picture in the NBA say similar things. Have you heard any similar concerns from NHL teams or NHL players that might indicate, you know, they're more concerned with just getting through this in one piece than actually going out there and competing for a playoff spot?
No, I haven't. And part of that is also the fact that we really haven't had much interaction with the guys in the last couple of weeks versus earlier in the pandemic. So as we've gotten closer to a return to play, you know, the number of sort of Zoom press conferences and stuff have certainly not been at the same levels as they were earlier in the process. So I think those questions might not necessarily be, aren't necessarily getting asked the same rate they are in say like the NBA or MLB. But I will say that in the conversations I've had with players and coaches in the last few months, I mean, it's always been that sort of expected hockey cliche focus on, well, if we're going to do this, then we're going to do this, then we're going to try to win, and an anticipation of getting back on the ice and anticipation of playing the games they miss, and all that kind of thing. And look, there's palpable worry, not only for themselves, but for their families, and also concern about being away from their families for as long as they might have to be. And that's why I think the, you know, no harm, no foul opt-out that the two sides have agreed on, where 3 days after ratification of this deal, any player can just say, I'm not doing this. It speaks to that concern, and it speaks to that notion that there are going to be players that don't want to come back. It's just that we don't know what the numbers are going to be and how many are going to choose to do so.
And you mentioned, you know, obviously the driving force behind this is the NHL needs to make up a lot of lost revenue that they're going to be missing. And it still remains to be seen going forward just how much revenue they lose as a result of this. Obviously a very, you know, fluid situation. We know that lots can change in the months and days to come. But as we sit here right now, how long do you think it will be before the NHL really recovers from this and revenues get back to, you know, where they were projected to go before this all started and the salary cap starts to rise again?
I mean, obviously this year's a wash. I think next year is too, insofar as we don't know what the crowds are going to look like next year at these arenas, and the NHL being a very gate-driven league and being reliant on that, what it's going to look like. Everybody I talked to in the run-up to the CBA Memorandum of Understanding kind of indicated they felt like the cap was going to be flat, you know, next season and potentially the season after that. That remains to be seen. We know what it's going to be next season. But I think the anticipation is that it's going to be maybe a two-year process to really kind of get this thing back to where it was, the sort of freight train of revenue that we've had for the last couple of seasons. But, I mean, the alleviation of these financial concerns, you could see it on the horizon. Not only that things are going to be a lot different from a pandemic standpoint in the next couple of years once we develop treatments and once we develop a vaccine, but also the pending U.S. broadcast rights contract, and the fact that a lot of people anticipate there being a financial windfall from all the ancillary revenues of the Seattle franchise. It's not going to be long until they can turn this thing around, but I think the next 2 years, at the very least, are going to be a struggle.
All right, let's talk about some non-pandemic related news. Patrick Mahomes signed this huge $500 million contract. And then looking at hockey contracts, not exactly the perfect scale, but you know, we've got one $100 million contract. How long will it take for another player to get a $100 million contract? Or what's the next threshold that we should be excited for?
Oh, man, I don't know. I'd have to look at the free agent docket for the next couple of years or whatever. But look, the bottom line for the NHL is that the players don't have the stomach for that fight. And the fight is that if you are in a salary cap league and the salary cap is linked to revenue, you are basically agreeing that the top players in your league are never going to be paid the commensurate amount of money that they deserve. And it's an absolute joke when you look at the amount of money the top players in the National Hockey League make versus the top players in other sports, that the numbers work out that way. Hockey, before the pandemic, hockey was a multi-billion dollar enterprise for the NHL. And the fact of the matter is this: back in 2005, there wasn't a salary cap put in place, and instead there was a luxury tax. Then we would see the top guys, the tippy-top guys, the Connor McDavids of the world, make the money they probably should be making. But because the NHLPA didn't stand its ground back then and isn't hungry for a fight right now when they actually do have leverage, let's face it. I mean, if they peaced out on July 9th and said, hey, let's rethink this financial system, I mean, it could get super ugly, but it's the only time since Gary Bettman's become commissioner they actually have leverage in the situation. But they don't have a stomach for that fight, and because of that, we're always going to see, at least under this financial system, the top guys not make as much money as they definitely should based on the amount of revenue the sport brings in.
We were just having a conversation about Chris Tanev, who is among the free agents that the Canucks are going to be looking to re-sign or walk away from. And just across the league, you know, with this flat cap, how much concern is there for players that are kind of going into, you know, murkiness of, you know, not that they're expecting a big windfall just because of their free agency, but now the whole economic landscape has changed. Just in your conversations, are players kind of shifting how they're approaching this free agency, and maybe security and staying close to where they are is going to be the prevailing thought?
Well, you know, I've always said that security and being close to where they are is always the first thing. I mean, if you could look at free agency in any offseason and say, that guy just wants to be near his stuff, you know, and not have to move his stuff. You know, his stuff's there. He's going to stick there. I think there's a lot of that that goes on in NHL free agency versus anywhere else. But I think in this case, you know, my thoughts go to the guys like Taylor Hall, like Alex Pietrangelo, to some of the bigger names in this offseason coming up, and wondering, you know, if they're going to try to defer, if they're going to try to take something short-term that maybe – you know, they can revisit in a couple of seasons when the cap is a little bit higher and revenues are stronger. Taylor Hall has said, you know, I'm looking for something long term no matter what happens. But with a flat cap and, you know, all of a sudden maybe the number of suitors he would have had otherwise aren't as prevalent, it remains to be seen, you know, what his plans might be going forward. I genuinely wonder whether we're going to see a change in the amount of years on a contract, or conversely, if they go longer term at a smaller cap hit just because of the flat cap.
Is Greg Wyshynski. If you aren't already, you can follow him on Twitter at Wyshynski, a writer for ESPN covering the NHL. Greg, thanks a lot.
Yeah, anytime.
Again, at ESPN.com doing great coverage with he and Emily Kaplan. As we get ready for this return to play scenario, Chris Tanev did join the station earlier today on the Scott Rintoul Show. We'll play a couple of clips back because he talked about his contractual future. He talked about playing with Quinn Hughes. So that's all coming up here on Social Distance Central. Bick Nizar and Jamie Dodd on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. It is Social Distance Central. Bick Nizar, Jamie Dodd on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. I wanted to clarify something we were talking about in our interview with Greg Wyshynski there, Jamie, because if you check out this thread with Justin Bourne, I thought it was interesting. I'm just going to try to read it somewhat verbatim here. As sports fans, now we hear and will hear more variations of, we knew there would be positive tests, etc., shaping all these positives as normal. It'd be nice to have some idea of what the leagues expected beforehand, what would be considered normal in terms of positive tests. Not like there's something sinister from the leagues, just don't want to hear, we all saw this coming. If there's an outbreak of a dozen tests, is one a disaster? I have trouble with the parameters of normal here. And I think it's a fair question on Justin's behalf there, because as much as we treat sports as a essential part of our being and our a way of life, it is somewhat a luxury. But you also have to understand it is its own business, and businesses have been afforded their opportunity to come back during this pandemic. And while sports has a higher profile than most other businesses, it's still, and I've been consistent on this, it deserves its opportunity to come back. Yes, there's higher risk because of the number of people involved, but the idea that we've seen people say over and over, oh, just cancel sports, what's the difference? It doesn't really matter. It's not important right now. I think those comments approach it from idea of this is only a luxury. You've got to look at the business aspect of this, and the NHL deserves, or any pro league deserves, their opportunity to try to make themselves not whole, but as close as possible. Having said that, some of the plans like the MLB one, I can't imagine how this is going to come off. The MLS, we've seen, already have some issues. The NBA has their plan, but the NHL one to me looks the most sound. Now, if the scenario develops where there's an outbreak within the bubble, as much as I've been supportive of the idea that they should get their opportunity, yesterday when I saw that thread, it was the first time I really, sat and really thought about, okay, what is actually my threshold for how many positive cases within the bubble I can withstand and I should change my tune then?
It's an important question. I think just in general, trying to kind of set parameters before you go into a situation is a useful goal. I do think the answer here is nobody knows exactly. There's no correct number. If you could pull a dozen epidemiologists and public health answers, and they would either probably all have different answers or all say, it's a case-by-case thing, we'll know it when we see it. I think that's kind of what Wyshynski said as well. You can't set a number on it beforehand. You'll just kind of know when you're at that tipping point. I think that's correct. To your larger point about, the NHL deserves its shot, I agree. There's two questions that all the sports leagues have to answer. There's one is internal, right? Can you agree with ownership and the league and the players? Can they all get on the same page and say, this is something that works for us and we're willing to give it a shot? And the league so far have been able to do that, some much more smoothly than other. And then the other question is, if you're just talking about, the shut it all down right now attitude, is does the league's operation put the public at unnecessary risk? And is the risk to the public, does that outweigh the reward of, the morale boost of having sports back? I don't think that's the case with the NHL or the NBA. I do kind of think that's the case with Major League Baseball. So I think in that instance, it's very, very fair for people to be saying, hey, what are you guys doing with this plan? In the case of the NHL, all of the affected parties have agreed to try this. Now, there could still very much so be a point where it gets out of hand and they have to walk it back and they have to cancel it. And again, we just don't know what that tipping point will be, but yeah, they've earned the right to do it, and they've gone about it the right way, making sure to get all of the different stakeholders on board first.
Yeah, I as much as I want to put a number on it, right, it's I've struggled trying to do that, and hearing the way Greg put it and us talking right now, it's one of those things that you have to go in with like a leap of faith to some degree, and that's scary, man, to having an uncertain landing. So, one case, I don't know how I'm going to react to it. Even one case within the bubble. And when that transpires, okay, you can ask me then if this was prudent to go ahead with this decision. But right now, it's just the way I look at it today, before we entered in this bubble, it's they deserve the opportunity to try to make it work. Yeah. And we've kind of made the comparison or the analogy of this is the best of a lot of bad options, but you got to merge the two ideas that they do deserve their best. They do deserve their opportunity to make it work. And this might be a bad option. Those two kind of can go in hand in hand.
Now, I will say, you know, we talk about not being able to put a number on it. If you as a person, I'm not saying this is where you stand, but just if anyone is sitting there saying if they get a single positive test from a player or a coach in the bubble, they have to shut it down. Well, to me, there's no point in going forward and even starting at that, because I am basically positive that there will be positive tests at some point in the bubble. Just because as much as we want to call this a bubble, it's impossible to have a perfectly hermetically sealed bubble where no one's going in or out. That's just not how it works. Staff, hotel people are going to be going to and from the bubble. So there's going to be chances for the virus to get in. And we've seen when that's the case, the virus will get in. The much more important question to me is not, can you keep the number of positive tests to zero? Because I don't think that's possible. It's what do you do when you do get the positive test, and can you keep it from spreading? That's the big question. And that will be ultimately what determines whether the NHL can finish this whole process. But anyone whose opinion is if they get one positive test, they should shut it down, well, then you're basically saying they shouldn't even start it up, because there's going to be positive tests.
Speaking of confidence within the bubble, Chris Tanev, when he joined Scott Rintoul earlier today, did talk about the idea. So here's Chris Tanev talking about his confidence inside the bubble.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with it. We've had lots of talks. I mean, hours of talking and hours of calls where infectious disease doctors are who are the experts and know a lot more than me are telling us that it's safe. And I mean, technically the bubble is going to be safer than anywhere else you're going to be, unless you never leave your house ever. So I mean, it's as they said, it should be safe as long as everyone follows the rules. And I mean, obviously there is a chance you can still contract it just going to the grocery store or going to get a coffee. But I mean, once we're in the bubble, we're not going to be leaving the bubble, and hopefully it goes well.
That's the voice of Chris Tanev when he met with Scott Rintoul earlier, exclusively on Sportsnet 650. And yeah, it's going to be a concern, and there's the, for the players, it's a difficult lifestyle for, you know, 3 months, although not everyone's going to be within the bubble for 3 months. As you know, teams progress in the playoffs and teams get eliminated, they will exit said bubble. But it's the lifestyle you're going to have to adhere to. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of communication from teams. That's why, you know, Chris Johnson has alluded to the idea of potential punitive damages to teams and players alike should they try to get out of the bubble. So it's having faith in the people that are setting this all up and trying to adhere to the guidelines.
Yeah, Chris Tanev makes a really interesting point that theoretically any individual player is going to be more safe in the bubble than they are outside the bubble, and certainly than they are in the kind of in-between stage when it's training camp in your home city. I think everyone agrees that's the trickiest part for this, because you have people interacting and getting together on a daily basis without the totally strict protocols that you're going to have in the bubble. So yeah, individually, it makes sense for players to look at it and say, yep, this is going to be a relatively safe environment for me. I'm willing to do it. The problem is there's just so many people involved that you're rolling the dice, you know, 700 times or whatever. And I think inevitably you're going to get a bad roll in a couple of those. Right. And again, that's why I say, you know, the most important thing isn't eliminating positive tests. It's limiting the spread once you do get those positive tests. And again, to Chris Tanev's point, all you can do is go on the advice of experts. It sounds like that's what the NHL has done. The PA has been involved in that process. Their demands have been satisfied. So there's no reason not to go ahead, but we also know that there's always going to be that underlying risk to this. Mm-hmm.
And just to give you an idea, like these hubs, right? So you're limited to 52 people per team. And how many teams are traveling to each of these hubs, right? You're looking at upwards of 600 people just from the teams alone.
Yeah. And then there will be some media, workers, some league people, yeah, workers, et cetera, right?
So it's a risk, but it's a risk that they're exploring how to pull off correctly. And yeah, I just thought it was an interesting note there from Justin of what was expected and what's your threshold as it continues. Because you're right, it's you're positive there's going to be a positive test at some point.
And I just on the threshold question, you know, to take it to another sport here for a second, you know, look at what's happening in MLS right now. They've had a team have to withdraw from that tournament, and it sounds like they're going to have another one pretty quickly here in Nashville. The Whitecaps went down to Orlando, but they left, I think, like their three first choice strikers at home with them. To me, MLS is pretty much over the threshold at this point. If you have teams withdrawing, if you have teams reporting at vastly reduced strength, at that point, I don't think the payoff is high enough for the risk you're undertaking. So again, there's no set number, but you look at some of those other signs, like teams dropping out, a significant number of players dropping out, games having to be rescheduled because of outbreaks, things like that. Those are the signs, more than a specific number of cases, that are going to tell us all, okay, we need to pump the brakes here.
If you missed it, let's continue to hear from Canucks D-man, Chris Tanev. He spoke on a bunch of stuff, including his future and staying in Vancouver.
I mean, I'm not really too worried about it. I'm going to go out and play hockey, and I feel like I'm going to play well. So, I mean, I'm going to go out there, give my best, and whatever happens. I mean, the cap isn't going to go down. It's going to stay flat for the next couple of years. So, I mean, we'll see what happens when that point crosses. But I mean, my main focus right now is to go out there and play good hockey and help our team win. Yeah, I mean, I think I've said it before. I love the city. I love the organization. I love my teammates are awesome. So, I mean, I'd love to play here my whole career. We'll see what happens. I mean, it's such a ever-changing world right now, and a lot of stuff is going on, and the landscape is changing very fluidly. So we'll see what happens in the fall, but I would love to be here the rest of my career.
It sounds like a guy who's got an open mind and is taking things in stride for the world we're living in right now. It's okay, focus on what you can focus on right now, and I guess we'll see what it looks like come the fall.
Yeah, and that's really all. What else can you say at this point? You have to, you can't, if you had a plan for your free agency locked in with your agent in September, you know, okay, this is I'm going into my UFA year. This is how we're going to play it. This is our strategy come July. That's all out the window. All you can do is be flexible and have an open mind right now. And that's the approach Tanev is going to take. I think that's the approach the Canucks have to take with Tanev as well. The Canucks probably had a number and a term in mind for Chris Tanev and when they wanted to get negotiations done and all that. They have to completely adapt on the fly as well. Both sides here are going to have to do that.
And the point that I've made is it's not that there's a declaration on Chris Tanev, the player. He's obviously a fine player and he's worth a certain dollar figure. I'm just curious if that's going to be valuable in the structure of what the Canucks are trying to build. And see how he plays with Quinn Hughes. Like Quinn Hughes is already the star of the D core, let alone the star of that D pairing. I'm not sure if it's required, or at least I don't buy into the argument that Chris Tanev needs to play with Quinn Hughes for Quinn Hughes to be effective. I just think Quinn Hughes is going to be fantastic whether he's with him or not. And so this was Chris Tanev talking about playing with Quinn Hughes.
Yeah, I thought we played very well together. I think there was a little stretch short in the middle of the season. We struggled a bit. But, I mean, I think when you play that much together, you're going to go through ups and downs. And we were, for the most part, I thought very good all year.
Every player is different. Did you change anything at all with your game, Chris, to tailor it to the way that Quinn Hughes plays?
No, I mean, I think regardless of who I'm playing with, I'm going to try to help them as much as I can, and I'm going to try to go and retrieve pucks and move the puck as much as I can and sort of let Quinn do his thing. I mean, he's a great skater, great with the puck, and he obviously shows that on the ice, how creative he is, how dynamic he is, and you sort of don't want to put any restraints on him at all.
Did it change the way you thought about your own role within the five skaters on the ice, particularly when you had the puck? Like, was there that mindset. Listen, when I get it, let's get it to Quinn Hughes as we head up ice as soon as I possibly can.
Not that way so much. I think it got me more involved. That's for sure. When you're in the offensive zone, I think you always need to be ready because you don't know what he's going to do. He's so creative and he thinks so fast that you need to be ready and you need to have a plan when that puck comes to you and make sure you're available and trying to help him and be an outlet as much as you can.
I know part of your role is, hey, you're the veteran. You're supposed to help usher this guy into the league. How do you think Quinn Hughes helped you in particular this year, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I've said it before. I had so much fun playing with Quinn, and I believe he definitely gets you more involved than playing with a different D partner. He's very dynamic. He moves, his lateral movement's incredible. He gets you involved in the offense. You're in the O-zone. We're sort of five guys can be in any position and you're moving the puck and trying to make plays. And it was a lot of fun.
That's Chris Tanev speaking to Scott Rintoul earlier today on the idea of playing with Quinn Hughes. And look, this is my point, is Quinn Hughes will do exactly that to a lot of different D-men. He will invite them into play. And talking about, you know, in the O-zone, five guys can be in any position. When you were habitually that stay-at-home D-man, and you're talking about, hey, I can try to be more creative because I play with this player, but that's also kind of goes counter to how I play. That's where I get the concern of, if you're committing $4.5 million plus to a player that, you know, his value is that stay-at-home D-man, playing with a guy who can be more creative. And I'm not saying freewheel hockey. It just, there are ways you see how Quinn Hughes and Tyler Myers play together in the offensive zone. It's very dominating. That's the point we're trying to make here.
Yeah, it's fair to point out that Chris Tanev did really well playing alongside Quinn Hughes, but so did Tyler Myers. I have a stinking suspicion that any NHL quality defenseman you put next to Quinn Hughes is going to do really well. And that's not a slight against Chris Tanev. He had a good season, but you do have to make
that's
an
a compliment effort. To Quinn Hughes. Like,
exactly.
That's
it's a huge compliment to Quinn Hughes. And you have to make an effort to separate the two factors, right? To try to isolate Chris Tanev's performance. That's not an easy task, but I think there has been a bit of a tendency in the market to say that combination is special and we need to keep them together because look how much success they had. Not taking anything away from them. Yeah, they were really effective, but you can go out and find other defensemen to play with Quinn Hughes. That's not a hard thing to find in the NHL, right? So the question is, what can they give you in other factors? How can they do if you have to split them up at some point? Because we know Travis Green has liked to use the Quinn Hughes-Tyler Myers pairing when he really needs a juice, to juice the offense a little bit. So it's great that Chris Tanev and Quinn Hughes had so much success, but that can't be the only thing you look at when you're evaluating Chris Tanev, because so much of the credit in that partnership has to go to Quinn Hughes.
And the other argument is, well, that's a big bet on believing Quinn Hughes is a top 10 D-man or he will make anyone better in the future. Look, I'm far more comfortable betting on elite talents than I am on non-elite players.
And
right? And Chris Tanev is great defensively, don't get me wrong. It just overall, as a rule, I would rather be wrong with elite players. It's the old, I would rather pay a star player $1 million more than two average players $1 million more.
And yeah, there is a risk betting on Quinn Hughes to be a super elite defenseman in the NHL. But at the same time, look at the Canucks salary cap situation and how it's going to be structured. If Quinn Hughes doesn't reach that level, they're not going anywhere. So you're kind of locked into that bet already, in a sense. You need Quinn Hughes to be that, and you kind of just have to plan around it, betting that he will, in fact, get there. Now, fortunately, there's lots of evidence to suggest that he is going to be an elite defenseman in the NHL for a long while, but I'm not sure how much you can really hedge your bets on that point, because if that doesn't pan out, you're in a world of trouble.
Sportsnet 650, it is Bick Nizar, Jamie Dodd on Social Distance Central. As you know, we do the Game It Takes, which you can jump online at Sportsnet 650. Chime in with your take. As we talked about it last week, but we turn it over to you. Are you pro winning for the playoffs, or are you pro going into the lottery? Not that Chris Tanev was trying to enter in Game of Takes, although, hey, Chris, we would absolutely love that if you want to chime in. But he did speak about his confidence going into the playoffs. For those of you that are pro playoffs, it sounds like Chris Tanev is also sharing your confidence.
Yeah, I think we can, I've said it before, I think we can beat anyone on any night if we're healthy and we're playing the proper way. So we have a lot of high-end skill, and our goaltender is amazing. So I think we have a great chance to go far if we come out of the gates hot here.
There you go. He's not a tankist. Very obviously. So,
can you imagine if he came out? You know what? I really like Alexis Lafreniere. He would look really good on this roster.
During this quarantine, I put my scouting hat on, and, you know, Quinton Byfield's really interesting too. Yeah. I don't really want Jamie Drysdale to take my job in the future, but man, he really impressed me.
He sprung for the Dauber Prospects subscription. He really dug into it.
Oh, man. Yeah, that'd be so hilarious. Again, we welcome your takes at Sportsnet 650 right now. So jump online and try to submit a take, and you could be featured on Thursday here on Social Distance Central. That's it for us. Me and Batch will be back tomorrow. I'll be back later tonight, actually, with Andrew Walker on the program. Elliot Friedman, on his holiday, no less, will join us at 4 o'clock. Obviously, big news going on in the NHL as they get ready for this return to play. We will talk, or Reach Deep is up, coming up next. They will talk to Eddie Lack on Taco Tuesdays coming up at 2 o'clock, plus Irfan Ghaffar at 3. On the way, on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.